So we can keep this informal. I've been asked how long the talk will be. I'll try to keep it short. And what I'm hoping to do is to talk about two of the projects that I'm working on. And they're quite different, but I'm going to try to make a pitch for how they're connected to each other. So the overall theme is statistical analysis in two different areas. And hopefully by the end, you'll understand the shaky, spiky, stormy, and sharp. So we'll get there. So I wanted to start by thinking about, you know, Ramon y Cajal. Imagine him, you know, in a philosophical mood late at night, reflecting on his career. And Stephen Smith talked last week about how one of the things that made, you know, that gave Cajal an advantage over Golgi was that he had a superior microscope. And so he must have thought to himself, you know, this is great, my career is based on optical imaging, but what actually sets the ultimate limit on optical resolution? Okay. Sorry? Right, so Ernst Abbe, you know, gave him the answer, and I'll show you how Abbe and Lord Rayleigh were off in the second half of the talk. But you know, maybe another question that would have... So one of the first things that Cajal did with his microscope is he looked at the neural circuits, in particular in the retina, and this is, I think Sarah suggested this as a logo for the course. So this is Cajal's drawing of the retina, and he must have also thought to himself, well, you know, what sets the ultimate limits on visual acuity, and how are those related to the retina? Okay, so maybe Cajal is the theme that unites the two halves of my talk. So I'm going to start with the visual acuity side, and talk about fundamental statistical limits on what's called visual hyperacuity, and I'll explain in just a second what I mean by that, and in particular how those are influenced by fixational eye movements that Steve Backus mentioned a little bit yesterday as well. And the goal will be to try to explain how the brain, in a biologically plausible way, might decode spikes from the retina to explain the performance that we see in behavior. In the second half of the talk, if I get there, I'll talk about super resolution microscopy. So this is there's actually a number of techniques in recent years that have emerged for beating the so-called diffraction limit, and the fact that the diffraction limit can be beaten suggests that it's not really a limit. So I'll be talking about what I think is a more fundamental statistical viewpoint for optical imaging. Okay, so the intuition for hyperacuity maybe comes from, so I know there's a lot of theorists here, but if any of you have ever worked in a lab, you might have used vernier calipers. And this goes back to, I think, like 1670s or something. There was a Frenchman named Vernier, Pierre Vernier, I think, Vernier, who invented this device. And the idea behind vernier calipers is that you can very precisely read out, if you look on the right, which pair of vertical bars is aligned compared with all the others that are not aligned with each other. So you can see the one marked in red is precisely aligned. And in fact, and so the fact that you can tell that very precisely is the basis for being able to read off a very fine scale measurement in this device. I won't go into, took me a few minutes to think about to remind myself how it works. Now, how precise is that? Well, the key question is how does it compare to the pixel size on the retina, the photoreceptor spacing? And that receptor size spacing is about half an arc minute or 30 arc seconds. So here you see a modern experiment, although this was first realized 100 years ago in the 1890s. The first psychophysics was done, and it was realized that the human limits on performance, the threshold for discriminating between, here you can see an edge that's where the vernier is either oriented to the left or to the right, the threshold for discriminating that is about 5 to 10 arc minutes, sorry, arc seconds. So about 5 times smaller than actually the spacing between receptors at the fovea. So that's why it's called hyperacuity. And already in the 1890s, when this was first documented, theorists started to think about what the explanation could be, and Ewald Hering, who's famous also for work on color opponency, proposed, and it might be obvious to a lot of you, that a possible explanation for this could be that if the brain is integrating information over multiple photoreceptors, multiple ganglion cells, then it could average the noise and achieve hyperacuity. So that's the schematic he proposed, and it's been very influential. I think that's basically how we think about it, although there is some controversy as to what extent integration over space is actually required. Now, that's been a very influential theory, and for 100 years, really, people haven't gone much beyond that idea. And in particular, they haven't considered what the role of eye movements could be. And so it turns out the eyes are never actually still. So this is just a little cartoon. You can imagine looking at an eye chart. Even in the periods between saccades, so during a nominal fixation, the eyes are actually moving. And so here's a recording of human eye movements. I think this is the horizontal eye movements. The vertical eye movements look similar. And you can see, so these authors sort of dissected the eye movements into three types. There are these discrete saccade-like movements that people call microsaccades. But even if you remove the microsaccades, here they call these overshoot. There's something they lump in and call drift. So I'm going to be focusing mostly on the non-saccadic forms of eye movements. But all of these essentially have the effect of blurring the image on the retina. And so that's the problem they pose. And in fact, they blur the question is how bad is the blur that they evoke? If the blur is smaller than the pixel size, then it shouldn't be an issue. Saccades are much bigger than this, right? So this is the scale is in a few minutes of arc. These authors actually also looked at the power spectrum of the eye movement. So if you look at the amplitude of the power at 40 to 100 hertz, the amplitude is around 6 arc seconds, which, if you remember, I said the human psychophysical threshold in vernier acuity is 5 to 10 arc seconds. So it's similar. And so it could be a problem for vernier acuity. Well, I'll show you that in the next slide. So the simplest model, I mean, there is structure in the eye movements, as you can see here, but the simplest model for it would be that it's simply a random walk. So here's a plot of the mean squared displacement as a function of time lag between, you know, the location at time zero and the location a few milliseconds later. So for a pure random walk, you'd predict that the mean squared displacement increases linearly. And obviously, it's not exactly linear, but that's the simplest model. And this constant capital D here is the diffusion coefficient, which turns out to be about 100 arc minutes squared per second. So maybe that's the scale you're asking about. Yeah. Well, yes, this is with the microsaccades removed. Yeah. Exactly. This is a different study, and I think different authors dissect those types of eye movements in different ways. So I think this is just removing the microsaccades. So in my talk, I'm going to be basically modeling the eye movements as random diffusion. You can see here a plot that shows an actual recording of an actual trajectory of a human eye movement, just superimposed on something meant to give you the scale of, imagine the smallest line on an eye chart at the ophthalmologist. And also the grid that you see beneath that shows the array of ganglion cell receptive fields in the fovea. So you can see that to tell the difference between the F and the P requires really information at the scale of a couple of individual pixels, individual receptors. And the eye movements during this half second fixation really move over many, many receptors. Yeah.
Are those ganglion cell receptive fields, or are those rod incoming receptive fields?
That's a good question. In the fovea, they're basically one-to-one. I don't remember what this. I'd have to go back and check what this actual plot is. But it's either rods or ganglion cells. It may be the rods. But in the fovea, they're basically in one-to-one correspondence. Yeah.
But isn't there also a point spread, just optical blur point spread function?
Yeah, but that's smaller. That's smaller. I mean, the I'm pretty sure it's I think it's about a micron or a couple of microns. The diffraction, I'm actually going to be talking about the diffraction limit in the second half of the talk, and that's much smaller than this. And I think the optics of the eye, they're not quite diffraction limited, but I'm not confident about that. We can go back and check, but. Sorry? I mean, the you know, if that
over lambda, right? If you have a 1 millimeter length,
right,
you have lambda which is 500 centimeters.
That depends on the color, yeah.
That means that you have 1/2000. Right? So
so I have to remind myself, what's the, so the, in microns, sorry? Okay, it could be. We can look at it afterwards. I seem to remember that it's on the order of one receptive field, the optical blurring. So it's not much more than one receptive field.
Okay, but it is then approximately
the polar receptive field. Yeah, right. Yeah. But it's not much bigger. That's the important point, right? If it were much bigger, then you'd have to worry about that blurring. The pixel size is sort of the smallest resolution that you can get in the retina. It's not limited by the optics. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
No, but you're going to do super resolution.
Well, that, not in the eye, yeah. Well, I mean, well, right, but you achieve hyperacuity by integrating over time, obviously, by averaging. So for example, for localizing the edge, you're saying that the edge could be blurred.
The edge is already blurred optically, so no amount of integration.
Well, okay, as you'll see in the second half of the talk, that's not quite the right way to think about it. Okay, so there's a number of open problems in hyperacuity related to eye movements. So what I'm going to try to answer in this talk is how an observer's performance should depend on the spacing of the photoreceptors, the amplitude of the eye movements, and also the statistics of the spiking. So the eye movements and the spiking are the two sort of sources of noise that should limit performance. And it's important to think about what's the optimal decoder of retinal spike trains. In other words, what should the brain do if it were optimal? And that sort of sets a benchmark for the best performance that could be achieved by any neural network. But we'll see that that's not a very realistic computation. And although it's mathematically simple, it's not biologically simple. But it turns out there's a near optimal biologically feasible decoder. So to introduce the model, we basically using a LN kind of model of the retina, in which we're assuming that an array of ganglion cells with Gaussian receptive fields. And for now, I'm assuming, in fact, in this whole talk, I'm going to assume no baseline spiking. That's something that we're working on adding to the model now, and I can talk about it at the end if you're interested. So it's a linear model of the filter, and then Poisson spiking to generate the spike trains. And again, we're modeling the eye movements as completely diffusive random walks. And so the question is, how can the brain interpret the noisy spikes that it's receiving from the retina to answer the psychophysics questions about the vernier?
How will it justify the assumption of Poisson spikes in the retina?
Right. Well, yeah. And in fact, we've looked a little bit at how different types of correlation. I mean, Elad gave a talk about how there are correlations between cells and deviations from Poisson. And in fact, I think certain kinds of correlations, such as synchrony in the retina, could improve performance on the task, and we've looked a little bit at that. But the simplest model to first order, the spiking is Poisson. Yeah, right. No, it. We're not sure. You know, there are the. That's a longer discussion. I mean, as Steve talked about yesterday, there are these object motion sensitive cells. So that's one mechanism you could imagine for those cells do compute eye movement in a sense. No, they don't. I mean, that doesn't seem to be the case. Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. Right. Okay. So this model has essentially four key length and time scales that determine its performance. And there's, depending on which experiments you want to compare with, there's a range of values for them, but I'll just give you an idea of what those ranges are. So in particular, a key thing obviously is the receptive field spacing, and this again depends on species, depends on eccentricity relative to the fovea, but we can assume that it's going to be somewhere around a couple of arc minutes, so the width of individual receptive fields. In fact, what I mean is the standard deviation of a Gaussian fit to the receptive field. The diffusion is described by a diffusion coefficient, which is 100 arc minutes squared per second. Another key quantity is the ganglion cell spike rate, which we're going to assume varies between 0 and 100 hertz. And finally, the length of the bar. The longer the bar is, the more information is coming in. And we're going to assume the length of each of the bars is about the size of one, on the order of one ganglion cell receptive field. So it turns out, actually, the first observation about this model is that you can combine these four parameters. In fact, you should combine these four parameters into one dimensionless quantity, which essentially determines how bad the eye movements are in their effect on acuity. So this parameter epsilon is essentially the mean squared displacement of the eyes between any two spikes in generated by the stimulus, any two evoked spikes. And putting together the numbers I showed you in the previous slide, this parameter turns out to be somewhere on the order of one, maybe a little bit less than one. Yeah, question. Oh, yeah. Well, fair or not fair, this quantity, it turns out, I'll show you in the theory, is the So rho here is the firing rate for a cell that's at the center of when the bar is in the center of the cell's receptive field. So all the other cells are silent. So it depends what you mean by the average over the population, but. I'm saying the maximum that you see when the bar is. I mean, I'm talking specifically about the vernier stimulus when the bar is over the cell's receptive is in the center of the cell's receptive field. That's what I'm assuming here. I mean, again, it doesn't. The only quantity that matters is epsilon, this dimensionless combination of them. Yeah. N is the number of ganglion cells that lie under the bar, so the number of the size of the neural population along. I'm sorry.
It doesn't have any dimension.
I haven't derived this. I haven't motivated this. I'll show you. In fact, I'm not deriving the math, but I'll show you how this. I'm just showing you that this is a dimensionless combination of the parameters, and it turns out that the performance depends on epsilon, and the optimal performance depends on epsilon. But it, I guess I can say more than that. It actually makes sense that it should go like this, because the more cells you have, the better the performance, right? So epsilon. I'm sorry? That's right. I mean, you could write down lots of other kinds of dimensionless quantities. That's right. The intuition is exactly what I wrote. This thing is the mean squared displacement between spikes. So, you know, if you wanted, you could do the mean squared displacement between spikes on a single cell, and that wouldn't have n. But this is the... Yeah, in units of the spacing of the photoreceptors, that's right. So the mean squared number of photoreceptors that the eyes move between two spikes in the population. Okay, Srini? Well, so far I haven't included any temporal filtering. I'll get to that. But the reason for looking at ganglion cells is because that's what the brain—that's the information the brain is receiving. It's getting spikes from ganglion cells. So what you want to decode is the ganglion cell output. Yeah, I'm talking about decoding. Yeah, right, that's right. Yes. Right, with a better retina, you could do better, sure. I mean, if you had higher spike rates or, yeah. I'm taking the retina as given. The retina, this is a model, I mean, you can argue about how realistic it is, but I'm not trying to optimize the retina. I'm just taking this as a model for the retinal spike generation and then asking how should you decode it. So I'm not working on the problem of encoding. Then you have more, yeah, I mean, if you had an extremely long bar, you'd get more independent samples of the stimulus and you'd get more information that way. That's right, yeah. It's the size of the network along the length of the bar. Okay? Let me keep going. I think it'll become clearer.
How do you know what the size of the bar is?
Well, you can control it in the experiments, yeah. Right. All the brain receives is the spikes from the ganglion cells. Yes, sir. Yeah. That's an interesting and important. I alluded to it earlier. It's controversial. I mean, there's data both ways, and I won't get into it, but. It turns out that people there are claims that you can do as well with a point like stimulus as you can with an extended stimulus. So, if you really want to know, we can talk about it at the end. Now, okay, this is maybe obvious at this point, but just to give you an intuition for what this parameter epsilon means, if epsilon is much less than one, here you see a simulation where the black trace is the eye movement trajectory, and you can see that in the time between spikes, so the blue spikes are coming from, let's say, the lower bar, and the red spikes from the upper bar, and the y-axis here corresponds to the location of the cell that spiked. So you can imagine that the distance between the mean of the blue spikes and the mean of the red spikes is the gap between the two bars, and that's what the brain is trying to estimate. That's the gap between the two verniers. Right. So I'm simulating a random walk here, and
its variance is not increasing with time.
Well, it is. It's just very little.
Very short,
yeah, that's right. This is a single trajectory. This is not an average. This is a single instance of the random walk, but it's with a small value of epsilon, and that's why it has a small amplitude. If I increase the value of epsilon, obviously the random walk has a larger variance now, and you can imagine that the problem of decoding the spikes is going to be harder here. Yeah. Yes.
But then why are there dots? Oh, okay, there's 5 cities.
5 cities, that's just a scale bar showing the length scale. So this is a model of a continuous population. So we're allowing the spikes to occur at any real value of x, and the idea is that so that's an approximation in the model. We're not actually modeling. It allows us to do the math, and we're not modeling discrete a discrete array. And you could think that that's reasonable if the bar is the only thing it's neglecting is the aliasing that comes from the discreteness of the receptor array.
So you're saying that because the Vernier is a long line,
right?
Then there could be neurons at all different
locations with respect to the sort of at all different spatial phases with respect to the actual location of the bar. So I'm not worrying about the discreteness of the receptor array. No, it's not. You can think of it as taking the limit of an infinitely long bar, but reducing the spike rate proportionally to keep the same spike rate of the population. That's one way to think about it. Yeah, Sarah. No. These are individual simulations of individual trials. So each dot is the location and time of a spike in the population. Each dot is one spike, yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Right. That's right. Yeah, exactly. So Mitra, I mean, I should say we've looked at the problem. I mean, this is, I think, an unconventional way of modeling the a neural population that turns out to be very convenient for this problem. And so we've done it in the more standard way as well. And the results basically agree. There's a certain kind of ergodicity assumption you have to assume. We can talk about it at the end. But essentially, we're assuming a continuous population, and so at every moment of time, there's a certain probability of a spike, and then a probability distribution over where that spike happens in the population.
And what is the spike from bar 1 or bar 2?
It's completely random; they're uncorrelated. So you just have two, but the two bars are at different locations. Right. So. Okay. Maybe I should. So the two bars are at different vertical locations. So the brain will know whether a spike is coming from the upper bar or the lower bar. That's a big distance, right? What I'm plotting here. This y-axis is the horizontal displacement, right? Right. No, but you have a finite number of spikes. You only have a discrete set of samples. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the performance gets better over time. I'll show you that. Yeah, the performance. No. The stimulus is only presented briefly. The stimulus typically is presented for a few hundred milliseconds. There's a significant drift during that time. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our model would predict that the longer the stimulus is presented, the better the performance. And of course, there's some limit psychophysically to how much it improves. But the optimal decoder should improve over time. And I'll talk about that.
The basic
It's the spikes and the eye movements. Those are the two, right, those are the two sources of variability.
But if I had access to the photoreceptor directly, then I would just read out.
Well, no, I mean, the physical limit is photons. I mean, you can, yeah, if you had a direct readout of the locations of all the photons, that would be a lot more information, that's right. But that's still discrete, and in the second half of the talk, I'll talk about microscopy, where that's essentially the limitation. It's the number of photons.
So it kind of implies that the information is there in the photoreceptor, and then it somehow applies to the spike.
That's true, yeah. That's probably true, yeah. 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 Well, we're modeling an array of on cells, so yeah, I mean, or off cells actually. So that's one of the ways in which, you know, our model doesn't have both on and off cells. So yeah. Okay. So before talking about the fundamental limits and the optimal decoder, let's just ask whether the most naive decoder is good enough. So that would be just, like I said, averaging the locations of all the spikes that came from the first bar and the locations of the spikes from the second bar and subtracting them. So this is the naive estimator for D. D, again, is the gap between the bars. The problem is that it turns out this variance decreases over time. So the first term on the left, it goes as 1 over time, but then there's this second term which doesn't decrease over time, so it saturates. So if we plot the performance over time, if epsilon is 0, if there's no eye movement, then the performance on this log-log plot falls off with slope 1. But as soon as there's any finite epsilon, that sets the scale at which the performance saturates. And it turns out... It turns out that actually with the numbers I showed you earlier, with epsilon around 0.1 to 1, that the performance actually stops improving after the first spike or few spikes. So in fact, there's no hyperacuity. The acuity is limited strictly by the size of the receptive field size of a single cell. Well, this comes from, you can just directly calculate the variance in our model of this estimator. If you want, we can go through it. But you know, I've got a model with Gaussian receptive fields and Poisson spiking. So that's where it comes from. Now, so. So that's what I just said. So this limiting error turns out to be on the order of sigma squared, where sigma is the size of the individual receptive fields. Yeah. Exactly. So we need to do better than this, and so we directly then ask, what's the optimal thing to do? What would be the optimal decoder? And so the idea here, I think this is probably pretty obvious to people in the room. Each spike that's observed from the array of ganglion cells contributes some evidence about where the bar actually is. So the evidence from this first spike. So if the first spike occurs at some location to the right of the actual location of the bar, that's its evidence. As we observe more and more spikes, we can combine the evidence by Bayes' rule and form the posterior distribution of where we think the actual bar is. Now, it turns out with the model that I've introduced, the posterior distribution is Gaussian. So it's only got two parameters, the mean, which is actually the maximum likelihood estimate of where the bar is, and the variance, which turns out to actually also be the variance of the maximum likelihood estimator. So in our model, we can calculate both of these parameters, and the variance is important because it corresponds to the psychophysical threshold that would be observed in an experiment. So first of all, what is the maximum likelihood estimator? So this is its form. Here, the notation is that X is a vector of the locations of all of the spikes, the locations of the centers of the receptive fields of all the neurons that spiked. S is a vector whose entries are, are plus or minus 1, corresponding to whether the spike was in the came from the first bar or the second bar. And sigma is a matrix that includes the information about the spike times. So here A is sort of like an integration over time, and delta is a matrix of the inner spike intervals between all of the spikes. And so it's not too not too complicated to write down mathematically, but it does involve this matrix inverse, which might be hard to implement biologically. But for now, let's look at what the performance of the optimal estimator is, because that sets sort of a limit on how well any decoder could do. Yeah. Right. Little d hat. Oh no, I'm sorry. ID is the identity matrix. A is essentially like a discrete integration over time. It's a matrix that has all ones on the lower below the diagonal and zero. It comes from the random walk statistics, from the fact that this is after averaging over the statistics of the random walk, you have correlation. The location at any time is correlated with previous times. The eye movement location of the current time is correlated with previous times. And delta is the matrix of inner spike intervals. So A times delta, delta is the, is if you think of the diagonal, delta is a diagonal matrix. The diagonal of delta is a vector of the inner spike intervals. So A times delta is the cumulative integral of that, which is just the times of the spikes. Maybe I should have included more details about the derivation of this, but I'd rather not get bogged down in the derivation, but this is essentially just comes from the random walk statistics. And you can see that if epsilon is zero, then sigma is just the identity matrix. And so let's actually look at, maybe it'll give you some intuition if we look at these in the two limits of small and large epsilon. So in, before I do that, let me just show you what the performance of the estimator is. So this again was the saturating performance of the naive estimator. And we can calculate what the performance of the optimal estimator is, and sure enough, it decays as 1 over t with a coefficient that depends on epsilon. So now the role of eye movements is no longer to saturate the performance of the decoder, but it just causes a different slope. Okay. So this means that the performance is going to improve the longer the subject stares at the vernier. Now, again, we can look under the hood of this decoder and ask what is it actually doing. So in the limit of epsilon going to zero, then it's again the trivial naive decoder that I showed earlier. So namely just taking the difference between the mean of the spikes from one population and the other. The opposite limit is more interesting. So if we make epsilon very large, neglecting the identity matrix in that equation I showed earlier. It turns out that what the decoder is doing is it's summing not over all spikes, but it's only summing over pairs of subsequent spikes. So here I've written that as switches. So times at which there was a spike, there was a near coincident spike in the two populations, pair of spikes in the two populations. And what it's summing is the delta x, the difference in positions of the two spikes, normalized by delta t, the time between the two spikes. So if there was a long time between the two spikes, that doesn't contribute much evidence because there could have been a lot of eye movement during that interval. Whereas if there's a very short delta t, that's a very informative pair of spikes. In the different, from opposite populations, right. Exactly. Right, so I'll show you something like that. Not quite that, but I'll show you something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this motivates something that might be a little bit more biologically plausible, because as I mentioned, the optimal decoder for finite epsilon, these are the two limits of epsilon equals zero and epsilon equals infinity. for finite epsilon, it's doing something much more complicated than either of these. It's actually taking into account all of the spike times. So what we want is a more biologically plausible decoder that perhaps approximates it. And the trick we use actually is very biologically artificial, but mathematically it makes the math much more simple. Namely, we assume that the spiking is very regular in the two populations. In other words, that all of the interspike intervals are the same. So the coefficient of variation for the whole population is zero. Well, yeah, it's a strange model. It's hard to think about it about how it would be generated by actual neurons. It's as if there were a clock that's saying, okay, at every millisecond there has to be a spike, but where that spike happens, which cell actually spikes, is random. But with that model, we can actually approximate the optimal decoder in the following way. So we can write it approximately as, so what happens then if you do that is that this delta matrix becomes deterministic, and you can actually approximate that matrix inverse as a sum over all spikes, now not just subsequent spikes, so over all spikes of xi minus xj, and as Surya suggested, you have a kernel f of ti minus tj, which gives more weight to spikes that happen, to pairs of spikes that happen nearby in time. That's right. That's right. So it's some constant times I minus J. Well, not exactly, because it's only the population of the whole the spiking of the whole population that's regular. Each cell is still pretty irregular and probably close to Poisson. So it's actually hard for me to imagine how you could get regular spiking biologically, but nevertheless, this would be the optimal decoder if you did get that. And so what we asked then is, let's just take this decoder and see how it performs in the presence of Poisson spiking. Well, it does, because so there's two differences. One is what you just mentioned, but the other is that here I'm summing over all spikes, and there it was just subsequent spikes. So since if you're assuming epsilon is large and you're only looking at subsequent spikes, the kernels will be very similar. That's right. That's right. Remember that in the previous thing I showed, you were only looking at subsequent spikes. In this, right? Right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So it could be a problem. That's right. So then we just ask, is it a problem, right? Yeah.
You mean because it doesn't have one of the delta TI?
Yeah. Why do you mind that the delta?
Well, because the delta TI is a constant in this case. So
yeah, yeah. But you don't know that part.
Right. Okay, so before I actually show you the performance, let me show you that this actually is sort of biologically plausible. And you can draw a network that would do this. In fact, it only requires a few neurons. So the imagine the populations of the two bars in the populations of retinal ganglion cells that are observing the two bars in orange and green. The ingredients that go into forming this decoder thing that I wrote on the previous slide are simply four cells which integrate the spikes from the ganglion cells linearly, either with weights that correspond to the locations of the ganglion cells or uniformly. Then we have a layer of linear filters, Lopez filters, whose time constant is given by is determined by the magnitude of the eye movements. We need some quadratic computations between comparisons between them, and then finally just an integration over time to sum up the evidence. Right. That's right, yeah. Well, that's what I argued at the beginning, that actually even with small epsilon, the performance of a naive decoder saturates very quickly. So you do need to take into account epsilon at least somehow. But perhaps it's enough to do it this way. So this is the performance of this decoder. The cyan line shows you, so first of all, the black dashed line is the optimal decoder, that one that involved the matrix inverse. And the cyan dashed line is simulations showing the performance of this more biologically feasible decoder, and it basically matches the performance of the optimal. Now, we can think about detuning the biological decoder by setting its time constant to be some fraction of the optimal time constant. And you can see that it's actually quite robust. So we can detune it by it's shown a little bit better in the next slide. We can detune it by some factor, and the performance still improves over time, which you wouldn't necessarily expect given the saturation of the naive decoder. And so here this just shows the performance over time as a function of that time constant tau compared with tau optimal. You can vary it by several percent, you know, by maybe 20-30%, and still achieve near optimal performance. So that suggests that it might be robust. Yeah. Yeah, it depends on epsilon, exactly. The optimal time constant is 1 over the square root of epsilon. The other parameters. You're asking, is it robust to those parameters? Yeah, we haven't looked at that. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. That's right. On epsilon. Right. I doubt it, but I haven't looked at it systematically yet. So one final point I'd like to make about this decoder is that actually the way I've drawn it, it looks somewhat akin to a decoder that's been proposed for fly vision, the Reichert correlator. And so, of course, including people in the room are still actively looking for where the Reichert correlator could be. I think they're more likely to find that before we find where the Vernier decoder is in the. This slide has not been approved by Marcus Meister. Okay, so the question came up earlier about temporal filtering, and that's one very. I would say there's two aspects of actual retinas that I've neglected that are very important. So one is the temporal filtering. So this is just an example of the spike triggered average for retinal ganglia for non-cell. And you can see that the temporal filtering extends over a couple hundred milliseconds. And you might imagine that would cause additional blurring. So let me show you that in simulation. So everything I've shown you so far has been with instantaneous spiking, namely that the probability of spiking at the current time just depends on the current eye position. But if we low-pass filter the spike rate by 100 milliseconds, what you can see, so the grayscale here is meant to represent the spike rate as a function of time and space in the retinal population, and you can see that the spikes are blurred out, and you can imagine that it would be much more difficult in this case to estimate the actual gap between the verniers. Now, this is something that would be very hard to compute the optimal filter for, the optimal decoder. But using the biologically plausible decoder I introduced, actually we can just go ahead and calculate what the performance of that decoder would be as a function of this time constant tau, which is the time constant of the retina. So that's shown here. So now we have two time constants, tau retina and tau decode. Again, tau decode was the time constant of our decoder, and tau retina is the filtering of the ganglion cells. And we can ask what the optimal value now of the decoder is, taking into account both the eye movements and the temporal filtering in the retina. So it turns out there's a contribution from both. This 1 over square root of epsilon is what we had in the absence of filtering from the retina. So if tau retina is 0, we just get 1 over square root of epsilon. There's a factor of 2 that, I apologize, we've changed our notation. But the temporal filtering in the retina requires increasing the time constant of the decoder to average over more spikes due to the fact that the spikes that are occurring at the current time actually depend on the activity on the on the stimulus over several hundred milliseconds in the past. Oh yeah. So that's right. So there's it's I'm missing a row. Row is the spike rate. The maximal spike rate. So that's right. So anywhere. So you can think of this as in units where rho is 1. So this is just a plot of that, showing that that when the retinal time constant is small, it's the decoder time constant, the optimal time constant, is just determined by epsilon. Maybe it's clearer if I show it as a 2D plot. And we can also calculate the performance. So this is the sort of phase diagram for the performance as a function of the eye movement amplitude and the temporal filtering of the retina. There's another element of realism in the retina that we haven't included yet, which I'm currently working to introduce, namely the background spiking, the fact that the ganglion cells don't have a non-zero background spike rate even in the absence of a stimulus. And we believe that we can analyze the decoder I've talked about even in the presence of that background spiking. Okay, so I've talked for about 50 minutes. Maybe I'll take questions on the vernier part, and then if I have a couple of minutes left, I can mention storm imaging if people are still interested. Yeah. So performance improves over time, as you'd predict, but it only improves for the first 100 to 300 milliseconds or so, and then it saturates. And the question of what the slope is as a function of time is also a little bit controversial. There seems to be a crossover. There's something called Bloch's law, which says that the performance as a function of contrast and time should scale as you'd expect based on the number of the amount of information that the retina is getting, and there's a regime in which the retina is consistent with Bloch's law, and then it violates it. But it saturates at a level that's much better than the naive decoder's performance. Right. We've thought about it. So far, ours doesn't saturate exactly. But it's easy to have a saturation. I mean, if you just have noise on the in the cortical representation of D, you have D hat, you're not going to represent it out to infinite number of decimal places. So it has to saturate at some point. Yeah. Yes, right. Yeah, I think that would also do it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's evidence, I'm not an expert on this, but I think there's evidence that microsaccades can be suppressed in well-trained monkeys and this kind of thing. But again, the model of eye movement that we've been using is a random walk, so it's more akin to like the drift that happens between microsaccades. Microsaccades would be sort of a separate problem. It can be 100 milliseconds, a couple of hundred milliseconds. Possibly. I would be surprised if we're not able to maintain information between the microseconds. Well, so psychophysically, it's been studied mostly in humans. There's physiology that's been done in macaques and cats. Clay Reed's lab has done some physiology in cats, I believe. And there's some recordings also from macaque retinas. So Clay Reed, I think, was in LGN. And the macaque stuff that I know, I think, is from retina. Okay. What I've talked about so far is how statistics limits the retina in estimating the location of a bar. So now let me just say a few words about how the same problem, essentially a very similar problem, has arisen in microscopy. So this is an example of a two-photon calcium imaging. Of two-photon calcium imaging from Arthur Conrad's lab. It's actually the paper that was mentioned earlier today, which was a really, really amazing paper. They were able to see hot spots on individual dendrites of a fluorescently labeled pyramidal cell corresponding to the locations at which the cell is receiving synaptic input. So that those are marked in red here. Now, you know, this raises a lot of questions, and there's a lot of structure that you'd like to see at the nanoscale here. So if you could actually see things like the spines or the receptors, that would be wonderful. But so far, optically, that's impossible. And the reason is, I think somebody mentioned Ernst Abbe earlier. Basically, the optical diffraction causes the image of a point emitter, a single fluorescent molecule, for example, to be blurred. So here, Lord Rayleigh proposed that you could think about resolution in terms of the resolvability of two points, namely if the points are so close together that their point spread function, their images overlap completely, then they're not resolvable. But as soon as you can see two distinct peaks, that's resolvable. A more modern viewpoint. And so then the key parameters are just the width of the point spread function and the separation of the features you're trying to estimate. Now, a more modern viewpoint actually thinks about this in the frequency domain in terms of the point spread function and actually the Fourier transform of the point spread function here, h of k. And if you square it, that's called the modulation transfer function. That essentially acts as a filter that filters the power at the high spatial frequencies in your image. And so h of k falls off this should be h of k and I of k on the last row. So at high spatial frequencies, h of k goes to zero, and that's why your linear model of the microscope is not transmitting that information. So it's essentially acting as a bandpass filter. So there's a couple of ways that people have proposed to beat the diffraction limit. You can go to short wavelength, and so we've had several talks about electron microscopy. That's one way. But of course, there's a lot of advantages to using light. You can do it in vivo. You can do functional imaging. So we'd like to use optics. Another approach that was popular mostly in the 80s is near-field optical microscopy, but that has a lot of disadvantages too. You have to bring a probe very close to the sample. You can do multi-photon microscopy, but what I'm going to be focusing on is a class of techniques called stochastic localization microscopy. So you may have heard of STORM and PALM. These are acronyms for conceptually very similar techniques that and I'll explain how they work in a second. And the reason I'm focusing on these is that this is really a paradigm for imaging that really sees imaging as a process of reconstructing an image computationally. So it's really different from previous ways of thinking about microscopy. So the idea in STORM imaging is that you have a set of very dilute, very sparse individual molecules, fluorescent molecules, that you image, and so you see a bunch of blobs, but you can very precisely localize, by whatever algorithm you choose to use, the centroids of those blobs, and thus estimate the locations of the emitters. The trick is then having a scheme for turning off those emitters, either by bleaching them or through other techniques, and turning on a new independently chosen subset of emitters, doing this sequentially in a series of rounds, so that in the end you build up a set of localizations which forms an estimate of the structure of the sample you're interested in imaging. So let me show you. This was from the supplemental information of the first Palm paper. And what you see on the left is the raw data. So that's a movie showing frame by frame the fluorescence that's collected. And in each frame, it's just a random subset of emitters that's activated. The middle image shows you what you would get from a conventional microscope. And that corresponds to essentially integrating over time, integrating the movie over time. Whereas on the right, and I'll just I'll play the movie one more time. On the right, what you see is the super resolution image being built up as a series of points. It's a little bit hard to see, but I can show you on the next slide what it looks like. So this is a cell where the lysosomes have been tagged by a fluorescent label, and clearly there's nanoscale structure in the image that was not resolvable optically. You take each frame and you analyze it separately to determine the locations of the emitters. That's right. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So where did Raleigh and Abbey go wrong? In other words, if diffraction was really a limit, how can this technique transcend it? And it might have occurred to you by now that the problem with Raleigh's theory of resolution is that it ignores noise. So in this scheme, what I've drawn here is the noiseless image of two emitters. But of course, if you knew exactly what the point spread function was, you could fit the point spread functions to any of these three cases and determine exactly where the emitters were. Yeah? Right, so I'm talking primarily about fluorescence imaging, Now, right, so if we actually consider noise, and there could be lots of sources of noise, but the most fundamental noise source which you'll never get rid of is the shot noise that comes from counting photons. So with a small number of photons observed, the histogram of the locations of the photons might look like this. And in this case, it would be difficult to actually fit the image to two emitters, whereas if you had observed a larger number of photons, it might be easier. So we need to update the framework for talking about optical resolution to actually include the effects of signal and noise. So to do that, I'm going to use something similar to what I talked about in the first part of the talk, namely estimation theory. Which starts with a statistical model. So before I told you about a model of how the retina generates spikes in response to a visual stimulus. Now I'm modeling how a microscope would record the locations of photons given a particular sample that you're trying to image. So for example, in the case of a microscope, this might be the product of the microscope's point spread function, where theta is now the location of the emitter or the fluorophore, and x is the location of the photon that's observed. So this would be the probability, the posterior distribution for this is the likelihood of observing a set of photon locations given a single emitter. The fundamental theorem of estimation theory. The Kramer-Rao theorem allows us to bound what the performance, what our performance would be if we try to estimate, for example, where the emitter is. So theta hat is now an estimator of the location of the emitter, and the variance of that estimator has to be larger than some lower bound, and this lower bound is given by the Fisher information. So here's the mathematical expression for it, and one way of thinking about the Fisher information is it's a measure of the signal to noise. It's a measure of how much the probability distribution for the photons depends on the actual location of the emitter. I won't say more than that about it at this point, but let me show you an example. It's evaluated at theta, the true value of theta. So theta is the actual emitter location, and it right. So let me give you a little bit of intuition for this by showing a simple example. Oh, and I should say that one nice feature of the Fisher information is that it's additive for independent estimates. So if you observe a set of n photons from the same emitter whose statistics are independent of each other, you have n times as much Fisher information. And so that's, so with n times as much Fisher information, the variance goes like the inverse of the Fisher information. That's why the variance goes as 1 over n. That's one way of thinking about the central limit theorem kind of argument. So here's a simple example. Let's say we have an emitter at location theta and a Gaussian receptive field. So the probability distribution is just this Gaussian. And in this case, the Fisher information is simply 1 over the variance of the Gaussian. And so that says that we can't do better than the variance of that Gaussian in estimating theta from a single emitter. Again, if we had n, a single photon, if we had n photons, we would do sigma squared over n. Now, we can then look at actual estimators and ask how well do they do. So this is the maximum likelihood estimator in this simple case. But there are other estimators. All three of these estimators are unbiased, namely, on average, they give you the right answer. But only the maximum likelihood estimator actually achieves the lower bound on variance given by this fundamental bound. So as might be obvious to you, theta c, for example, is just estimating the location of the emitter by taking just a single photon's location. So you're throwing away all of the other information. So obviously, you do worse in that case. OK? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Okay, I'm getting there. Right. Right, so that's the motivation for looking at this. It should allow us to ask what are the optimal experimental parameters to maximize the information about the sample. Palm and Storm have a certain set of parameters. One of them in particular, as Surya mentioned, is the density of emitters. And so the density of emitters is an important parameter because if you go to very low density, I'm talking about the instantaneous density during a single frame. If you go to very low density, then the experiment takes a very long time. And if you want to do that in a live cell, you won't have enough time. Whereas if you go to high density, now you've got overlap between emitters, and so you're losing all of the super resolution information. So there's a trade-off, and so this framework should allow us to see where the optimum is in terms of right. Yeah, that's exactly the right intuition, but this is doing it quantitatively. I mean, this actually lets us. It turns out, so one perhaps surprising thing is that it depends on the size of the features you're interested in. If in other words, the spatial frequency you're trying to estimate, and I'll get to that at the end. If you're only interested in coarse spatial features, you might as well use a very high density of emitters. If you're interested in very super resolution, very fine spatial features, you have to go to low density. Okay, so then if anybody's interested in the rest, they'll have to ask me over coffee. Let me just say who my collaborators are. I'd feel guilty if I. So the hyperacuity stuff was done with Yaron Burak, Marcus Meister, and Chaim Sampolinski, and Offer is a postdoc in Marcus Meister's lab who's doing experiments that hopefully could test some of these ideas. And the super resolution stuff was with Mark Schnitzer. So thanks all for coming Friday afternoon.